Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. This morning from the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a very special guest joining us, the founder and managing partner of Strive Capital, Nuno Gonçalves Pedro. Nuno, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Kunal.
Very excited to have you.
Excited to be here.
So let's jump into the first question. Tell me about yourself and your background and how it led to you to the path of VC.
So I have a long, winding background. I'll try and summarize it as well as I can, although I do always fail to do the elevator pitch on my own background. I've been in tech now for 24 years, actually, as of the end of this month. And I've had three very different stages of my career. Originally an engineer, I have a master's in science and computer engineering. And I started by developing systems, some of them, shockingly enough, still in production today, still being used today all around the world. I then became an engineering manager. I wasn't a 10x developer. And very early on, I believe the competitive side of me told me, you need to be the best at, or one of the best at what you do. And this is not that thing. So became an engineering manager and over time a product manager. I jokingly say I always should have stayed as a product manager. And had I been a product manager in Silicon Valley rather than at that time in Portugal, where I'm originally from, I probably would still be a product manager today. So that's the first cycle of my career, really, the direct tech development, product development part of my career. The second cycle was really where I sold a little bit to the dark side and became a growth operator, a manager, and basically took responsibilities for different areas of growth. On the organic side, really product strategy, product planning, product management. And then in your inorganic side, really around business development. So strategic partnerships, alliances, high-touch sales, and corporate development, M&A, and investment. Finally, I also always had a component to my work, which was really very strategic. So I did a lot of strategy work, business operations, and a few other things. Had a few scale-up situations in my career during that stage, some really significant ones. From, you know, one that comes to mind is taking an organization from 25 people to 1,000, 5 million in income to 200-something million in income, mostly actually through inorganic growth. And so very proud of that part of my career. I then took a little bit of a turn that I still put a little bit inside my operator part of the career, where I joined McKinsey & Company in Asia Pacific, and I was a senior expert and member of the leadership team there for 6 years. And there, the work I did was always around the same topic. So product, corporate development, business development. So think of it, of me a little bit as a guinea pig or one of the guinea pigs at that moment in time for what has now become the new McKinsey, a McKinsey that does offerings that go well beyond management consulting with McKinsey Digital Labs, McKinsey Solutions, and a few other areas that they've launched since then. I was based in Beijing, so my shifts are always significant. I shift continent when I shift my career and had actually an amazing time at the firm. And I'm very proud of the work we did back then and certainly of McKinsey as an organization. Around that time, I started really getting intrigued by startups, intrigued by companies that scaled really, really rapidly. I'd helped one company when I was coming out of GSM Association and actually helped them even exit to a NASDAQ quoted company. And the bug was already there. So I was really, you know, stuck with that bug in my head. And so started spending time 2007 in Silicon Valley in the Bay Area. At that time, San Francisco wasn't really a center like it is today. It was really more Silicon Valley or classic Silicon Valley, you know, Palo Alto, Mountain View, Sunnyvale, etc. And took a few advisory board positions that really led me to understand the startup cycle a little bit better. And then there was a really significant eureka moment in my career, which is the launch of the App Store by Apple in 2008. And the view that there was going to be a mobile app economy. And having worked a lot around mobile, I decided it was time for me to put money where my mouth was and be beyond a consultant and started at that point in time Strive Capital, which I'm still managing today, on the verge of our third vehicle, having really worked very extensively in our first and second vehicles with investments like Appany, Gusto, Rubrik, Virta Health, DraftKings, and a few others that people might know of. More recently, I've also taken a venture partner role in the last 2 years with Grishin Robotics, which is more of a physical tech, frontier tech investor. And I've really stepped between those two worlds, the consumer software as a service space, where I really focus most of my activity at Strive on, and then the Grishin Robotics world. This is a Sandhill Road fund that focuses a little bit more on the physical tech space. I would say if I have any skew as a venture capitalist, it's really, you know, towards consumer or consumer-like software as a service. So I like the dynamics of consumer. A lot of investors avoid consumer because it's very difficult. It's difficult to predict what's going to be big or not. That's really the space where I thrive. And addressing the end of your question on the path to VC, in some ways VC brings everything together. It brings my engineering background together, my product management background together, my growth operator background into play. And using a term that Amazon, for example, uses, a little bit the notion that venture capitalists that probably do the best are some sort of athletes. They are broad at the top, general managers, as we used to call them, but they actually have one or two spikes where they're really, really, really good at. And that's been, I think, the case with me, hopefully, with a little bit of eating a little bit of a humble pie, but, you know, very spiked on corporate and business development and product. And at the same time, someone who's had this overlay around general management, strategy, and a few other areas that lead me to understand new industries very, very rapidly, to make a distinction around what works and what doesn't work in an industry pretty quickly, but also over time, really understanding people, which is one of the big dimensions of being an investor, understanding how people behave, what leads to grit, what leads to, you know, incredible entrepreneurs versus people that actually give up at the first sign of issues. So a long-winded answer again, I can't quite nail my elevator pitch yet, but basically, that's my arc.
Nuno, it was a fantastic pitch. Now, I know you'd mentioned earlier in the conversation, you were talking about one of your most recent projects, right? Which is being the managing partner of Strive Capital. So what is the fund investment thesis and what type of check sizes do you write?
And I'll start with the foolish part. A lot of people think that all venture capitalists are incredibly well in life and we're all amazing and we get paid a lot of money with management fees and we have amazing salaries and we have this, you know, it's a profession that in some ways it's incredibly misunderstood and glorified for the wrong things. I love being a venture capitalist, but I'm actually an entrepreneur in venture capital and started Strive Capital from scratch with a co-founder. The first stuff we did was around 2010 and then more formally moved into the Bay Area in 2012. Strive Capital, the objective of Strive Capital, the first fund, was really to participate in the mobile app economy. And very early on, we realized that the only way to de-risk in particular investments in consumer is to see if there's ways to cheat your assessment of the company. And so the way we started cheating in some ways, and I'm using obviously a very strong word, is we started to be very analytical about the evaluation of deals. And we'll come back to that probably later, but that was a little bit what was the genesis of Strive Capital. Very early stage, we were doing Series Seed when Series Seed still didn't have properly a name. So we were thinking about rounds between 1 million to 1.5 million. Obviously, Series Seed has changed quite a bit in the last 8 years in terms of size. We were very focused on the consumer space and early on what we believed was a big trend. Again, I think we were a little bit ahead of our time, maybe a little bit too much ahead of our time in some cases, which was consumerized enterprise, what some people now call bottom-up software as a service and other services. And we were writing small checks. We were a micro venture capital firm. We were writing $500K to $1 million checks. Strive has evolved. The second vehicle, again, writing a variety of checks around the space, again, mostly focused on Series Seed. And then the third vehicle that we're now working on is going to focus on the new Series Seed, which is now $3 to $5 million rounds. And so we will effectively step into that with more capital per deal, but some of the similar dynamics that have happened over time. So Strive Capital has evolved through time. It has really maintained this logic of We are here to obviously support entrepreneurs, to choose the best entrepreneurs, but we're also here to be a great fund manager and really have the core skills of a great fund manager.
So from my understanding as well, you guys have a very different type of model, right? You're one of the first quant-focused micro VC funds. So what types of analytics are you using to derive early stage investments other than just betting on the team and the product prototype, like most early stage and micro VCs bet on?
And to demystify a little bit the quant VC side, it's not like, you know, me and my partner, when we first started this and then I stayed with the firm and he moved on to go back to being an entrepreneur. It's not that, you know, we initially said we're going to have this grand aim of being quant. As I mentioned before, it was just investing in consumer. We needed to significantly de-risk product market fit. That's the single most difficult part of investing in consumer, which is to anticipate whether there will be consumer product market fit or not. So that's where we started from. We started from the notion of, if we have data on companies early on around traction and sentiment, and over time we started focusing a lot more on retention and engagement metrics, we would highly de-risk those deals. And we started realizing, actually, not only would that help us in doing due diligence on companies we were looking at, so what we would call the mid-funnel piece close to deal making, but actually that would help us as well with a top-of-funnel piece in deal sourcing. We could identify companies that we would have otherwise missed by looking at data in a relatively unbiased manner. And I think that's what the analytics-driven piece brings to the table. It brings a de-risking of certain aspects of analyzing a company, which we think are fundamental, but it also brings sort of the debiasing of the whole process. You know, we in VCs have our own networks. We, you know, you're either a Stanford alum or a Berkeley alum or, you know, an IST alum in Portugal. And so you have these networks of influence and access. And so your sample of deal flow normally is not random. And what we believe was that the analytics engines would help us with both of those things. What we've realized over time is actually we can really amp up the analytics. Again, very focused on deal sourcing and due diligence. And we really can create feedback loops into our own process of decision making as we move forward down the funnel. You know, into fund three, as we're going now, there is really a thesis and an architecture that we believe is incredibly differentiated from the rest of the market. And if you think about it, and not to be too professorial, there's been a lot of focus by VC firms in what I would call the classic playbook that probably originated post 2001, 2002, after that crisis, which was really around creating brands and creating playbooks around networks of influence. I'd say Andreessen Horowitz was probably, you know, as a firm, the most aggressive one, really around 2009, 2010, coming out with very aggressive PR. I would say Mark Suster at Upfront, again, someone who played that playbook exceptionally well with both sides of the table. That playbook, I think, is a little bit tired, so it doesn't work as well going forward. And what we've seen is, again, in some ways, Andreessen Horowitz being, again, one of the innovators in that space, moving to post-investment and really, while having a lot of assets under management, bringing a lot of shared services to the table, from market development to marketing to PR to their portfolio companies. We believe that's all great. And you can play those playbooks, and particularly if you have a lot of assets under management. But if you have less under assets under management, you need to actually innovate in other parts of the puzzle. And actually, if you think about it quite quickly, you would say that the picking piece of venture capital is where most of the value is created. So the deal sourcing up to deal making is normally where value creates. And my thesis is you can't, as a venture capital firm, magically turn a company that would have been a 1x, 2x otherwise into 100x just because of the value that you bring post-investment. So upfront, you really need to focus a lot on the picking part. And I think Benchmark has edified that very strongly, a firm that has been very historically focused on picking. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to innovate around the picking stage. We're trying to really de-risk everything. And we're playing every other game that every other fund is doing as well, creating brand, networks of influence. But we're adding the layer. We're augmenting ourselves with analytics engines while putting, you know, the human part, you know, strongly in the loop. So this is not a system that makes decisions for us. It's a system that augments us and helps us make decisions. But in the end, there's always a human involved. And Kunal, I think, you know, there are elements of the evaluation and due diligence of in early stage. This is early stage. I mean, early stage is very difficult, right? You have to take into account the teams. You have to take into account, you know, the CEO, the founding team, and do a lot of evaluation that really you can't do just through analytics. And that piece, we believe we also have an edge. We believe we also have an ability to do that. But I don't think, you know, in my lifetime, I'm making a bet here, that, you know, analytics engines will ever replace humans fully in early stage investing, because it's just an impossibility. There's so many degrees of evaluation that are very difficult to actually model that I don't think that will happen, certainly in my lifetime.
Yeah, I can't agree more. Prior in the conversation, you had spoken about, you know, consumer services, the consumer services route in general, right? So what are some of the trends you're kind of seeing just in general in that industry?
We are in the midst of an amazing transformational environment. First, we're in the midst of a demographic change where we have Gen Zers emerging with a huge amount of wallet and ability to spend. And it's obviously only going to increase as they become, obviously, more, you know, part of the market and the mainstream market, leading companies, managing companies, et cetera. So that's one shift that was already happening. And Gen Zers are very different from millennials. Their habits are different. The way they look at services is different. The way you're going to need to address them from a social perspective, from a social network perspective, from a communications perspective is different than we Gen Xers or millennials have been addressed. The second big generational shift, which has been happening for quite a long time, is the world is becoming more and more aged, in particular in developed markets. Portugal, for example, I believe is the fourth oldest country in the world in terms of average age right now. And so there is a need to serve this demographic. And the cool thing about this demographic is, for the first time, this demographic is actually relatively technology savvy. So we're having people going into their 60s, 65s that is actually more technology savvy, that actually knows how to use technologies. And certainly their children, which are probably in their 40s, are incredibly technology savvy. So there's a lot of opportunity around that. So that's one other piece of the demographic shift. But now we just had COVID. And COVID changes, I think, a lot. Because at the end of the day, remote working becomes of age. The notion of distancing becomes more important. The risks that you take while traveling are taken certainly in a different degree. The bar for traveling, I think, has gone up dramatically. It will continue going up as we move forward. So this piece of COVID by itself has created another shift in consumer behaviors that we're seeing right now, with Zoom going through the roof today, with companies that are around the space, around gaming, for example, going through the roof, while you have companies that are in the travel space, in the hotel space, in the restaurant space, that are unfortunately going through an apocalypse that nobody could have predicted. And that is going to shift things. So, for example, in the food space, grocery shopping has become of age, but also in terms of food delivery and food pickup, I don't see any world under which food pickup and food delivery doesn't really significantly scale going forward. So that becomes almost like a premise of creating a new restaurant. If I'm going to do a new restaurant, maybe I'll have a really refined in-dining experience that probably will be actually quite expensive. But then I need to also cater the food delivery piece and the takeout piece in a different manner. So I think it's very, very exciting times if you're coming into this space. These trends are going to definitely get augmented over the next 5 to 10 years. I don't think COVID is done yet. I don't think COVID will be done by the end of the year either. So these are going to have lasting effects. And for me, lasting effects always come from the notion that if you are, for example, confined in shelter in place in lockdown, if you are limited by your activities for a significant amount of time, your habits will change. There's no other way, your habits will change. So this is not just a blip. I believe what we're seeing with COVID right now and with this generational shift will bring in a lot of new winners to the consumer services space.
So now, in regards to the your involvement in physical tech, frontier tech, and deep tech, what are some interesting trends that you're seeing in that space as well?
So two different aspects, the physical tech piece and the frontier and deep tech. On the frontier in deep tech, just a very quick thing, we look at frontier in deep tech from the perspective of a product manager. So we never look at technologies just for the sake of technology and how it's going to disrupt the world in maybe 20 years or 30 years. We look at something that as a business can it sustain itself and become big within the next 5 to 10 years. So when we look at frontier tech and deep tech, it's the underlying piece of technology that we evaluate. But at the end of the day, we're really always looking at market, team, and product, and whether that combination is powerful or not. We spend a lot of time, you know, focused on whether that product or that line of products can serve basic user needs, right? Be it consumers, be it enterprise, be it industrial, but we spend a lot of time on that. So on the deep tech and on the frontier tech side of the fence, we're a little bit controversial as investors, because we have a strong belief that it's really about the end game of serving users, not so much about the technology being fundamentally disruptive per se. On the physical tech side, the notion of, for example, what Christian Robotics does came from something really interesting, which is if you look at the world, it has become increasingly digitized over the last 2 decades. It's actually increasingly digitized over the last 3 months. We've probably had one of the biggest digital disruptions in history, just compressed into the last 3 months. But in some ways, the physical world hasn't really caught up. The physical world's still behind. The metaphors of the physical world are not working as well. And there's one example I always give, and there's a new example that has obviously emanated from the whole situation with coronavirus. The one that just, you know, came out is obviously the notion of food and how food is consumed and how food is taken and how it's observed, where the current physical logic of a restaurant doesn't make much sense, right? What we're dealing with right now, it's an adaptation, but obviously the restaurants of the future will need to be ready for that, will need to be ready for those user flows. The other example I always give is actually the example around the self-driving car. Everyone talks about the self-driving car, but you know, once you don't actually need to drive it in a world where there's level 5, what does the car become? Is it a living room? Is it a working room? You know, how does the cockpit actually change? You know, what changes would the chassis need to have? And so it's very basic examples just to make a point, which is physical tech needs to catch up. And so I think we're going through right now a disruption of sorts of that space. The cost curves haven't quite hit the same curves as software, but I think they will at some point in time. We're seeing what I believe to be the renaissance of the physical tech space. And that's why we play in that, because we think there's a lot of things that play in that space. To be clear, we don't invest in things that are physical only or hardware only. We invest in things that are physical or hardware, but that have either a software layer or a service layer where there's incremental revenue. It's not about, I just sold you, you know, a wearable. It's about how do I do things then about the wearable. And again, going back to my thesis around consumer, it becomes very much around traction, around retention and engagement as a view to product market fit. So it's very, very similar in some ways in terms of analysis to consumer software.
Nuno, thank you for that insight. And moving into this aspect of you having an engineering background and working in 35 countries so far in your career, what was your experience like and what has it kind of taught you in life?
Let's start with the engineering piece. Engineering is really about problem solving. And just to be clear, I come from an engineering background in a country which is Portugal. As I said, I did a master's in science and computer engineering, which has a similar system to the sort of French system, where engineering actually matters a lot. And, you know, it is about structural issues, it's about architectures, it's not just about, for example, if you're a computer engineer, just coding, right? It's about understanding languages deeply, creating languages, creating compilers, etc. So that mindset is a mindset that one is very curious. It's a mindset that's always about curiosity, about learning something new very rapidly and very quickly, be it a language, be it an architecture or a platform. So that's one element of that culture. The second element of the culture is at the base of it, engineering is problem solving. And almost everything in the world is problem solving. I mean, there's some valid exceptions, but almost everything in the world is problem solving. And so in some ways, I think the engineering background was the right background for someone like me. I was a curious person. I'm by nature a nerd. I still am a nerd, to be clear. And so the engineering piece really brought it all together. And till this day, I use a lot of the engineering principles. Going into a meeting room and meeting, for example, a founder of a company that's doing prefab construction for single family homes. And you've never, I had no basic understanding of the space at all, you know, construction space, obviously at a very high level, but definitely not the industry itself, certainly not in the US. And getting it in like 1 hour, getting the key levers in 1 hour. It's not that I became an expert in 1 hour, but it's like I understood the key levers of that industry and what matters to that company, the 80% answer, so to speak, of what I need to look into detail when I'm doing a due diligence, for example, in that 1 hour. That I think is a really engineering type skill. And I'm not disrespecting any other professions or academic backgrounds, but I think engineers are incredibly well suited for this type of problem solving. The other piece you mentioned too is the fact that I've worked in over 35 countries. And again, it wasn't by design, it just happened. I started traveling when I was a kid, and in some ways, probably my parents realized very early on that I wasn't your typical Portuguese kid, that I was really excited. I think the first moment where they realized that I probably wasn't the typical Portuguese kid is I was five and we did a summer trip through the Benelux, so France and Belgium and the Netherlands and Germany and Luxembourg. And at the end of it, they asked me, what was your favorite, you know, place, right? And of course, you know, they expected me to say Paris or Brussels or, you know, because we had some chocolate in Brussels, etc. So, and I told them Germany, right? And they were like, why? And I was like, well, because it just works, right? And I was five, right? So that's sort of the piece of me where in some ways I'm very Latin, but in some ways I'm very Germanic as well. So maybe the Anglo-Saxon environment is the right environment for me. But very early on, I realized I got it. I understood people and I wasn't really very biased. I would look at people and their interactions with me and I'd try and understand how they were different. And that has served me incredibly well. And it's been really a blessing to me, the fact that I've worked in so many countries. Because if, for example, I lived in Beijing for 6 years, but I worked quite extensively in Korea, Japan, and Southeast Asia, you know, going from Beijing to Seoul, everyone's like, well, it's an hour and a half flight. Yeah, but I mean, you might as well be in another continent, right? I always say Asia Pacific is a Western construct. It doesn't exist, right? It's a collection of countries. It's not a collection of regions. You know, Koreans are very different from Chinese. Northern Chinese are very different from Southern Chinese or from Shanghainese. And so all of those lessons learned were very powerful. I remember it always happened to me in winter when I was at McKinsey, I would fly between the Far East, so Beijing, Korea, Japan, and Southeast Asia systematically. And you know, you go from, I don't know, Tokyo and you land in Singapore, again, you're in a different world. Singapore is actually pretty well organized, but if you land, for example, in Jakarta, it's a different world altogether. And sometimes I remember there was a time where I was landing in Dhaka, right? Dhaka to Tokyo is a little bit of a shift, right, in terms of mindset. But having the appreciation that that shift is not, you know, judgmental. It's not about being better or worse. It's not that Dhaka is worse than Tokyo. It's Dhaka is different than Tokyo. And for example, my experience in Dhaka is a great example of that because I worked with incredible talent there. The same in India. You know, going to New Delhi or Bangalore, the talent is exceptional. The infrastructure is different. The infrastructure is different. It's maybe less evolved to the naked eye. But having that ability to be multicultural has taught me a lot. And if you look at Silicon Valley and the Bay Area in terms of startups and companies, there's so much diversity in entrepreneurs here that actually I think that gives me an edge again. I'm not your classic guy that was, you know, born and raised in the US. And so in some ways I have the ability, if I see a team of foreign entrepreneurs that are just happen to be here building their company, I will give them the discount of understanding the culture they come from, on how they pitch, on how they create noise. You know, it's very obvious to me that an American entrepreneur, someone that was born and raised in the US, that was that grew up through debate teams, through the ability to discourse, to the ability of sell, right, from very early on as a kid, you know, will have an edge on pitching versus someone maybe that's German, that's more matter-of-factly, or someone that maybe their English is not very good. And that gives me an edge because, you know, you're not going to be successful just because you're a better salesman. That helps as well. And that is important for fundraising, but it's not the only thing. You're going to be successful if you're a better operator, if you're a better builder of companies. And I think having worked in all these countries gives me this extra edge. And again, I feel very blessed. I feel very blessed for all the places I've been to in my life and all the experience I've had. And I've had generally exceptional experiences everywhere I went in the world.
That is fantastic. I think, you know, one thing that I would add, and tell me if this is true or not, but you know, especially when traveling around Asia Pacific, right? When you travel between Japan to South Korea, the cultures are total opposites, but it must have taught you how to tailor a management style to work in different work cultures.
Yes, it gives you flexibility. You become flexible in how you address teams. You can't always be what I call rugby pack mentality, where you have a bunch of people that work for you day in and day out. We're all in this together. We kick ass, but also you motivate people through incentives and sometimes even quasi-aggression. You know, that doesn't work in many parts of the world. Many parts of the world that doesn't work at all. You have to understand hierarchy. You have to understand how people interact with each other. To give an example, I won't say the name of the company, but I work with a company in Japan. And at a certain point in time, I realized there was someone in the organization, and this was a, let's call it the director level person. But this person somehow was not only updating his direct VP, but he was also updating a VP from another part of the organization. That confused the hell out of me. And I was starting to realize that actually he was paying more attention to the VP in the other part of the organization than the VP in his own part of the organization. And I just asked, and actually it took me more than asking, because everyone on the team didn't want to tell me, not my own team at the firm, but also with the team of the client, nobody wanted to tell me. And so effectively, finally, after gaining trust, after a couple of months doing this, someone, you know, over dinner told me, yes, that person manifests reporting to both VPs, because although that person today reports to this one VP, this VP is coming from the business side of the company, and the other VP is coming from the engineering side of the company. And this person right now reports to the VP on the business side, but this person comes from the engineering side, and his career will likely evolve on the engineering side. That's why he's reporting to both. And so things like that, I mean, this is like a small nuance, but it's actually a huge nuance, right? Because when you're thinking about influencing organizations, getting stuff done, you know, how do you get it done? Sometimes it's also good to know what rules you can break. I'm a bit of a hacker. You know, some people call me a people hacker, which I don't necessarily, I love the term hacker. I'm not sure I love people hacker because I'm not manipulative. I'm authentic in how I do things. And at a certain point in time, my realization has been that the way to work in multicultural environments does sometimes involve breaking rules. And I remember in Korea, there was a very hierarchical way of booking meetings with people, for example. And over time, I started breaking that rule. And I was always playing the I'm not from here card, but I was playing it in a polite manner. So it wasn't fundamentally disrespectful to the organization and to the people that had the role of being the gatekeepers. But at a certain point in time, I was like, you know what? I actually can deal without the gatekeepers. And that made me more effective and efficient as well in that environment. So it's a little bit of both. You have to understand the cultural piece, not just to abide by it, but also to be able to fundamentally break it once in a while.
Very, very, very interesting examples. To wrap up our call, right, with our last question here today, the reason I save this as our last question is because I do want to spend some time on this. Is I hear you are a personal coach to entrepreneurs, right? And recently launched a methodology on rejection and adversity and a path to growth, which focuses on how one can rewire their brain and change their way of thinking in order to push their boundaries, right? And in 2017, you had a dark period, and it caused you to push into this notion of the growth and fixed mindset and how it plays a role in social cognitive approach to mindset and personality. Can you tell us more about this theory of yours and how it kind of came to light based off the 2017 experience?
Yes, and just before I go there, stepping back a little bit, you know, I became an investor coming out of McKinsey, as I said, foolishly enough, as an entrepreneur in venture capital. And over the years, what started happening was, as I was saying no to companies, and just to be clear, you know, in venture capital, you mostly say no to companies. You know, our top of funnel is 1,000 companies, 2,000 companies, sometimes even more a year. And maybe you make 5, 6, maybe 10. If you're doing a lot of investment, maybe 20 investments a year. So you're saying no to a lot of people. And while I was doing that, some of the no's didn't really take no for an answer, and they kept coming back to me and said, but I want you involved. How can we get you involved? So over the years, I did very selectively a few advisory roles or senior advisory roles with with companies and startups. I still do. And it's kept my knowledge very fresh. It's kept me very close to the knowledge of the companies, not just as an investor that's a little bit more active, which I would have done anyway, but also as an advisor. And over the years, the other thing that started happening was individuals that were bringing me in to be an advisor to their company started saying, actually, can you help me as an individual? Can you help me become a better manager, leader? And so a little bit by accident, I became, without any formation around psychology or any area around it, just to be clear. So I have a lot of respect for people that are coming from that background. I became a coach to a bunch of entrepreneurs through the years. And as I was going through that journey, I was going through my own personal journey like everyone else and the complexities of my own personal journey, which I have a video on it. And I did a talk last year where I first launched the methodology on rejection and adversity as a path to growth, which is on YouTube. And that video really edifies, you know, the 2017 story. But to be honest, it's not just the 2017 story. It's the 2020 story. My beginning of year was particularly difficult at a personal and professional level. And then COVID happened, which has been difficult for all of us on a massive scale globally. So rejection adversity is something that is really very intrinsic to humanity. We are rejected all the time. And sometimes just because, you know, people say no, but it's not really personal. We have to deal with adverse situations. I mean, COVID is a brilliant example of that, but adverse situations all the time, from the tiny ones of I'm looking for a parking spot, I can't find it, to the, you know, I have cancer, to the someone in my family passed away, to the I was going for a new job within my organization and I didn't get it, or a new role or a promotion. So there's all these elements of rejection adversity that are very transversal to our lives, in our personal lives, in our professional lives. And at a certain point in time, I just decided to stop. There was a very good friend of mine, she was in many ways the motivation to this evolution of thinking, where in some ways I always did my coaching, I always did my advisory, relatively one-on-one or with very small groups. And I decided I want to do something that's a little bit more evangelizing people. It's more, you know, multicast. And for a long time, I was struggling with the fact that I talk a lot about venture capital, the spaces I invest in, stuff that I know really, really well, the functions I've worked in. And that's all very cool and it's interesting. But I wanted to talk about something that came from within that I was very passionate about. And that's how this methodology was born, really as a talk initially, which is the talk that's on YouTube. And then it evolved since then to become a much bigger piece to it. And it's also led me, to re-engage with old friends and companies that I'd invested in particular with Bertrand Schmidt, who was the co-founder, former CEO, now chairman of App Annie, a very old friend that we finally decided to do stuff together. We actually launched our own podcast, Tech Deciphered, which is maybe a bit foolishly as well. But going back to the rejection adversity methodology, it starts from really two different points. The first point you've already alluded to, which is the notion that growth mindset is actually much more powerful or flexible mindset versus versus having, you know, a mindset that is fixed. And what we mean by that is people that are focused a lot on the ability to learn and become better, and that focus their education or the education of their children around that, normally are following the right path. So normally people that are focused on learning and becoming better, so more the sweat piece of the puzzle, do better than those that are fixed, that are focused too much on the fixed mindset part of the picture, which is the innate capability part. So when you're, you know, a classic example is when you're teaching your kid. So if you're teaching your kid and your kid does something exceptional, he has an A+ at school, the fixed mindset person would likely say, oh, you're so intelligent, you're so smart. Whereas the person that's really more focused on the growth mindset would basically tell the kid, you've worked so hard, you've done so well because of working so hard and learning. So again, a very anecdotal evidence, but that's how you distinguish them. So I'm a big believer in the growth mindset. I'm a big believer in the flexible mindset piece of the puzzle. And it's what's led me to where I am today. And I think there's now a lot of scientific evidence that that's the path to follow. But on the other hand, you have this difficulty that you have to go through. And people talk a lot about, for example, grit, right? Grit, the ability to withstand pain, the ability to go and move forward. And at a certain point in my life, I stopped and I said, what if the painful experiences of our life, the traumatic experiences of our life, the adversities of our life, the no's of our life, what if we could actually not just withstand them, but thrive coming out of it? So as an analogy, the analogy would be that, for example, of a trampoline, right? You assume that you're in a fall, but at the end of the fall, you have a trampoline. If you hit it just right, you'll come back faster to even a higher height than you were before. Another analogy would be pruning, right? Obviously used in gardening a lot. You cut so that you can grow faster in some ways. And that was the genesis of the whole notion. Can we fundamentally shift our brains, rewire ourselves? Are there hacks? Are there methodologies? Are there operating models that we can follow as individuals that are helpful to us both professionally and personally to actually catalyze rejection and adversity as a positive thing, where you not only withstand it, but you come out of it much stronger, faster? And that's how the whole thing was started. Now, I won't take away, the methodology has evolved a lot, so the talk on YouTube is sort of only a snapshot of what the methodology has become. I've now worked with startups, either as an investor, as an advisor. I've worked with individuals as a coach. I've worked with big corporation actually as an advisor as well. And so this methodology has now become pretty self-encompassing. But just to give you a few ideas on the hacking side, I call them the hacks. By the way, I hate these guru-like speeches that are all about problem statements and structuring, but then at the end there's no how to. So what do I do now, right? So okay, you frame all the issues I have, you frame all the problems I have, great, and so now what do I do? So when I first started this thing, even the first talk, I was very insistent I need to have how-tos at the back end, at the end of the talk. Just to name a couple, but one that is very close to me right now, one would be obviously the notion of true north. It's very easy to catalyze yourself out of rejection and adversity if you know there's a true north, if you know there's something or someone that you should aim at looking at as an example to get you out of it. And in the world of non-spiritual world, that would mean something like, you know, friends or mentors that you highly regard in the specific space that your issue has happened in, right? So it's not just a mentor in X, but then your issue was in Y and somehow magically you go to that mentor. It's, you know, people that are appropriate to that space and looking at those people to edify you, to help you, you know, get out of that space. The second piece around True North is obviously if you're spiritual, if you're religious in any way, the notion of God, the notion of having, you know, a spiritual entity that is higher, that becomes more of a truth towards you. So that notion of True North, I think, is a very powerful one. In some ways, people that are more spiritual and religious, initially, I think, have an unfair advantage, but over time, it doesn't matter. It's really about this notion that there's a true north that you should aim at, that you should talk to people that would help you bring you out of it. One other piece, for example, that I always talk about is how you face rejection itself. And a lot of people take rejection very personally. Now, in my experience, most rejection is actually not personal at all. It's about something. When someone tells you you're not getting this job or you're not getting this promotion, very rarely it's deeply personal. It's about sort of relative evaluation of several people. It's about the needs of the specific job profile and specific role. Even if there's politics, even if there's sort of a bad blood at a personal level, sometimes it's not even that personal. So again, you know, the ability for you to de-bias yourself once you go through it and say, you know what, actually, this was not caused at a personal level. This is not personal at all. This was a decision that was made on something other than personal. And how you catalyze yourself out of that is a very powerful mechanism. So there's a bunch of other hacks. People have now told me they're actually not hacks. They're sort of ways of life and philosophies, et cetera. But I call them hacks because they start as hacks and then they evolve into something else that I'm very passionate about, because I have to use this myself all the time. It's not just I create a methodology and I'm perfect. My life is amazing. And after 2017, I've never had an issue in my life. I've had a bunch of other issues. So it's that notion that it's an ever evolving process and methodology that's very powerful in making you more efficient, more effective, but fundamentally happier. For me, the key thing here is there's a lot of coaches and a lot of advisors, a lot of people out there that believe the whole thesis should be about performance. It's like athletes. You should be an athlete. It's about performance. I think being an athlete and having great performance is really important, but you also need to be happy. So I defend that you need to have both. You need to have the performance aspect of training as a professional, as an executive, as a venture capitalist, as a startup entrepreneur. At the same time, you need to find happiness. You need to find this notion of contentment in the life that you have, which is really very, very powerful. If you have one without the other, it rarely works. That type of fulfillment is normally a very empty fulfillment. So that's why I'm so passionate about this topic and methodology.
Nuno, for listeners out there who are interested in contacting you further, or entrepreneurs looking for a potential investment, what would be the best point of contact?
So the best point of contact normally is LinkedIn, and just send me a message saying you heard this podcast. We have other mechanisms as well. We, you know, Tech Deciphered, as I mentioned, the podcast, would love to have you guys listen to that as well. And we also have ways of contacting us through that podcast. So that's another way of contacting us. I'd say those are the two more classic ones, through LinkedIn and through Tech Deciphered. But I'm very open. Do please explain that you heard this so that I have a little bit of context on why we're connecting. But I'm very open to talking to people and catching up with people. I've been very fortunate in my life to have had people that have influenced my lives in great ways and in small ways, mentors and just people that pass through my life. And so I like to give back in some ways, in the same way that I was given.
Nuno, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley. And thank you just so much for joining us today.
Kunal, thank you so much.